Some people say that God is dead, by which they seem to mean, when you get through all of the rhetoric with which they sometimes seem to be concealing what they're trying to say, men no longer believe there is a God in the traditional sense of the word. Well, I want to suggest this morning that man is dead in the same sense, that men no longer believe that there is a man in the traditional sense of the word. And I'm going to be talking on this theme, trying to show some of the implications of what I think to be the case today and Thursday and Saturday at this time. And the implications of this thesis will, I hope, emerge more clearly as we progress through this. I do believe, I'll tell you in advance, that these two things are related, because I'll be arguing that the essence of man, of humanity, is a certain capacity. If man denies that he has this capacity, he winds up denying that he is man. And this capacity turns out to be also a capacity to discern something which transcends man. I don't find it at all surprising, my way of looking at things. The age in which God is dead is the age in which man is dead too. These two things are causally related, they're interrelated. The death of one causes the death of the other. Of course, that may not be true. And I want to assure you in advance that I have nothing definitive to say. These are reflections, considerations that have been working around in me, some of them for several years, some ideas that I've worked out just in the past year. And the method that I want to employ in talking with you is what I call rational discourse. I want you to weigh and consider the things that I say. Don't be too quick either to accept or to reject. I'm going to try to point to certain phenomena with which we are all more or less familiar and ask what they mean. I have been given no Mount Nebo from which to view the promised land. Luther once defined pneuma, which is the Greek word for spirit in the New Testament, as, quote, the highest and noblest part of man, which qualifies him to lay hold of incomprehensible, invisible, eternal things. In short, it is the house where faith and God's word are at home. The spirit of man, then, according to Luther, is a capacity. It's some kind of power of comprehending, grasping. When St. Paul speaks, the author does it, spirit, mind, and body, he too seems to be distinguishing aspects of man. And now, whether or not this would be St. Paul's definition of pneuma, and I have my Greek lexicon's authority for saying that it would be. I'm going to mean by spirit this capacity of man, what some call the rational part of man, the power of perceiving and grasping, especially, the power of perceiving and grasping the element of depth, of mystery in all that is, the divine, that which is unconditioned. Now, what this means will perhaps emerge more clearly later. At very minimum, when I talk about spirituality or rationality, and I'm going to use those as synonyms, the spirit of man and the reason of man are, as far as I can see, really synonymous verbs. At minimum, I mean man's power of transcending himself, of going beyond himself, contemplating that, contemplating his destiny, his very power of asking, what am I? Of finding himself a problem to himself. When I talk now about the death of man, what I mean is that this capacity man is being diminished in our time. Our generation, our century perhaps, I believe has been systematically scraping off sandpapering away this spiritual or rational capacity of man. It has done so in the name of truth, but interestingly enough, by denying finally that it's possible to talk about truth at all. Well, where do we begin? Where do we look to see whether there's anything to this? I think you can look almost anywhere. If I am correct that what has happened in our time is that we have begun to operate with certain very deep cultural presuppositions, that certain, you might say, absolute presuppositions, things that are we so take for granted that we don't even realize we take them for granted. If I am correct that certain presuppositions of this sort, which imply the death of man, are operating in our culture, then we ought to be able to look at almost anything that goes on in our culture and see evidence of it. You dig a little anywhere and you get water. Well, that's what I'm going to try to get you to do by looking at some very particular and concrete things. And it would be bad if you got so hung up in the instances I use that you didn't always ask the question, well, what is this really expressing? Because that's what I'm after. I'm going to begin with Esquire magazine. And I don't particularly want to pick on Esquire magazine. I think there's some very good stuff in Esquire magazine. And in any event, I think Esquire is doing us a great service by bringing out in a very dramatic and vivid fashion some of the things that are being done to a lesser extent, maybe less openly and candidly, by such other magazines as Life and Look and Time. But the problem, you see, is this, that a fish doesn't know he's in water. Because he's, you're in a completely watery universe, you don't even know what water is, because you've never seen not water. And if indeed we are operating with certain absolute presuppositions, we won't be aware of it. Marshall McLuhan says, environments are invisible. It's the most fundamental things that you believe, that you aren't aware of believing. And if you try to get at them directly, we don't recognize them. You have to sort of try to bring out the invisible writing. That's what I'm trying to do by looking at Esquire. Now, interesting thing is that you could take almost any issue of Esquire within the last year, and you would find the same sort of thing that I'm going to talk about. Well, I'm going to begin by picking on the February issue. The February issue of Esquire magazine had a big, almost life-size picture of Roy Cohn on the cover. And above his head was a metal halo, and the caption said, Joe McCarthy's Roy Cohn tells it like it was. Well, now, you all remember Roy Cohn, suppose. Most of you old enough to remember it. He was the special investigating counsel of the late Senator Joseph McCarthy. You all recall the first of the great television spectaculars. I'm not interested in the details of those events, but I do want to remind you that this country in 1954 was profoundly divided over the questions that McCarthy was raising. The nation was going through a crisis of sorts. And I think the televised hearings, the so-called McCarthy Army hearings, were symptoms of a rather profound national crisis. Okay, now why is Esquire resurrecting these events 14 years later? Is it to give us a new perspective on a troubled time? It's valid. Is it to examine once again in the now emotionally less charged atmosphere those troublesome questions, the very important questions that underlay these events? Take a look at the cover, take a look at the captions, go into the article and look at it. It's perfectly obvious that is not Esquire's intention at all. I mean, the cover picture with its metallic halo, the sardonic caption, Joe McCarthy's Roy Cohn tells it like it was. The title chosen for the article inside the magazine, this is the title. Believe me, this is the truth about the Army McCarthy hearings, honestly. That's the title. And the subtitle announces, the newest version of the myth. Well now, let me make it plain, I am not interested in defending Roy Cohn. I I was completely out of sympathy with Roy Cole and Joseph McCarthy, then and I'm still with. I think McCarthy and Cole were either dishonest or very, very sadly misguided. I think they were tragic for this country. And Cole made his own decision to appear in Esquire. He got paid very well, I'm sure, because he wrote the article. And so I don't want to defend him. What I do want to note is the clear and repeated implication of the magazine's editors that there is no truth about this or about anything else. I mean, Roy Cohn tells it like it was. You know, you're supposed to believe me, this is the truth, honestly. the newest version of the myth. It's all myth, you see. Everybody plays his little game, everybody bounces around on the stage in his particular comedy, and Esquire just reports it for our titillation. I mean, what is there but titillation after all? And this is not an isolated instance. The covers of Esquire, month after month, make the same tiresome point. I find most of Esquire's covers really obscene. It was much better in the days when they put girly on. Their covers imply everybody's a fraud, a buffoon, except maybe you and me, of course. That's why Esquire publishes it, so you and me can laugh about it, so we can learn how to sneer. Sneer, man. You know, that's what you gotta do. If you don't sneer, you may be found out. Laugh at everybody, or people will think you didn't get the joke. Your basic attitude is supposed to be supercilious contempt. Or else somebody will suspect you of being a silly sentimentalist or a pompous fraud, or you know, a Victorian moralist who secretly reads nudie magazine. Actually, I think the worst, most grisly cover that Esquire ran was the November one, 67. It showed a big portrait of Svetlana Alavilyeva, Stalin's daughter. Didn't you see that? Or hear the reactions, the repercussions? Well, and her father's mustache was drawn on the picture. Very crude. On the cover, this big, almost life-size again picture of Svetlana with her father's mustache drawn on. And the caption in this case said, "How Svetlana fled communism for America and found God, happiness, and $2 million. And the article inside maintained the theme. Everybody connected with Stalin's daughter and her exodus to America was an idiot, or an egoist, or a silly simpleton. The point was, people never do anything for good reason. Reasons, those are the drugs with which we stupefy ourselves. Principles, beliefs, traditions of civility, or anything else, I mean, it is to lack. I guess I got particularly burned about that because one of the really distinguished statesmen of our time, George Kent, was treated in that article like some kind of moron. It's sneering type of reporting. You report little things like his shoelaces were untied. because this is the idea, you see. Let us peer over the walls of everyone's privy, because what we see then is the truth, if there is such a thing as truth at all. Now, this seems to be very often the editorial philosophy of Esquire magazine. Nothing is of value. Rationality is rationalization. Great men, their stuffed shirts, who have body odor and torn underwear. Courage is silliness. Virtue is cant. Truth is the proposition that there is no truth, and since that's so, let's all join to sneer at the silly soldiers who make themselves ludicrous with their pretensions to purpose. All right? I'm not interested in attacking or defending sacred cows. I don't want to attack satire, but aren't there two kinds of satirists? One satirist reduces, a satirist always reduces something to absurdity. But one kind of satirist reduces something that he hates to absurdity because of what he loves. And there's another kind of satirist who loves nothing. But he simply reduces everything to absurdity because he enjoys reducing things to absurdity. Because he wants to be funny. Because he wants us all to join in sneering. Satire can be loving. But then you have to satirize from a point of view. And I'm afraid I would have to call that a position of love. But the Esquire satirist, his motive is not the love of truth, but contempt for anything that passes as true. The satirist who works without love, without participation in the folly that he caricatures, works purely out of contempt for the human situation. This is the kind of satire that seems to me to dominate Esquire magazine. Now, there have always been nihilists, and I say there's no point in picking on Esquire. My point is not that Esquire deserves special condemnation. I subscribe to it. Perhaps it merits special applause for casting into high relief the presuppositions by which I think our culture is increasingly informed. As I said, I think if you go through other magazines in the newspapers, you find this emerging time and again. There is no truth. There's always a rationalization behind the reason. Everybody's basically a moron. When you catch a guy off guard, that's when you catch him at his most truthful. I want to turn someplace else now, look at something else that's happening in our culture, something totally different, where I think the same presuppositions are working themselves out. I want to look at the discipline of philosophy. Now, what's the situation in philosophy today? I think I'm lucky there are no philosophers here. Barely. I think they would agree with this. Philosophers agree with this. Some people would say that philosophy today, the discipline of philosophy, is grown humble. One time, philosophers saw themselves as the people who had the task of summing up all knowledge, but no longer. The task of philosophy today, especially in Anglo-American circles, is that of playing the role of a servant. Philosophy is no longer supposed to rule the lower sciences, but it's supposed to just sort of help them by polishing up their tools, sweeping the dust out of their workshops. These are images that are used by philosophers. Philosophy itself is not just a special science. What it does is try to keep the special sciences like psychology and physics and sociology from drifting into muddles. And it does that by analyzing their language and trying to clarify the logical problems into which these sciences get. But the genuinely productive work is done by the physicists, the psychologists, and the sociologists. And all the philosopher does is make sure that while these men are working, the sawdust and the shavings that fall from their table don't sort of blow back into the tools and mess everything up. That's a very humble view of philosophy. One time, philosophy was considered philos sophia, the love of wisdom. But today, philosophy is increasingly formal logic and the analysis of ordinary language. Why? Well, what's happened to cast philosophy from her throne? Above all, I submit, it is a crisis of reason. According to the classic philosophical tradition, reason is that structure of the mind which enables man to grasp and transform reality. And it was long the common assumption of all philosophers that reason is capable of grasping reality and shaping reality. What this meant was that either there is some kind of underlying identity between the world and the mind of man, his rational capacity, or some kind of functional interdependence between subjective thought and objective reality. But in any event, because of the way things are, the mind can grasp reality. There was certainly, in the classic tradition, no unbridgeable gulf between the world out there and the world as we see it. But that faith in some kind of ultimate unity between the mind and the world, or some correspondence at least between thought and its object, I think that faith has almost disappeared. If you put forward any such claim today, you're accused of dogmatism, metaphysics. Truth, we are told, is always relative to a starting point, and all starting points are arbitrary. Reason cannot ultimately judge between contending assertions, because reason herself has been judged and found wanting. You can't trust reason. You know, that raises the interesting question. By whom has reason been judged and found wanting? Before what tribunal can man arraign reason? It's easy to point out the errors into which men drift by reasoning. It's possible to point out the limits beyond which reason seemingly cannot pass. We can even raise the question whether reason is itself capable of grasping and shaping reality. But who raises the question? Who presents the indictment? Who hands down the verdict? The answer, of course, is reason. I don't know any other answer that you can give. It is reason which indicts herself. And of course, thereby, in some sense, reason establishes her own claims, does she not? If reason is the judge that sits in judgment on reason, then reason is, according to herself, some power to really make judgments. In the very process of reasoning, bringing reason into court, we don't notice it all the time, but we are affirming our confidence in reason. W. McNeill Dixon somewhere makes a comment about this. And he says, I find it most intriguing how men can saw off the branches on which they are sitting while continuing with superb confidence to sit upon them. I mean, this is such a common mark of our times in academic circles. You can't trust reason. You know, reason is an erring assertion. You know, who says so? Well, I reasoned it out. Of course, you can get around this by refusing to ask the question. And I think that is one of the hallmarks of contemporary philosophy. It simply refuses to ask embarrassing questions. What it does instead is it takes as given a starting point, a set of premises, a body of procedures, some language that people are using or that scientists are using, and then it confines itself to tracing out the implications of this starting point. You start anywhere and I'll show you, if you want to begin here, if you want to do this, if this is the way you want to play the game, I'll show you what's going to happen. But I can't tell you where to begin. I can't tell you anything about starting points. Reason cannot judge. Philosophy cannot judge between starting points. When asked to do this, philosophy takes refuge in that most respectable of contemporary citadels, absolute relativism. Which I think is an interesting combination of words, but I'm going to use it again on Thursday and make more out of it. I think this is the dominant faith of our time, absolute relativism. It all depends on where you begin and who is to judge among beginning points. I mean, surely not the philosopher. He has no credentials for the task. You could refer to this, and it has been referred to by some people, as the decline of philosophy, except for the fact that many philosophers are obviously very happy with the present situation. They say philosophy has long tried to do too much. It attempted to do the impossible. Philosophers once thought, foolishly, that they could say what is, that they could summarize all knowledge, that philosophy could be the general science of knowledge. But the progress of science, and usually here you can read for science physics, the progress of science has finally taught us that true knowledge is advanced by specialization, by self-limitation, by dealing with small corners of the universe, one at a time. Philosophy, they say, has finally learned its lesson, and is now ready to take its humble place in the great army of diligent plotters after bits and pieces of knowledge. Well, there's a great deal to that. I mean, it certainly is true. Knowledge has been advanced by specialization. It just isn't possible today anymore for a man even to be a biologist. You've got to be a molecular biologist. You can't even be that. There's a story of George Gaylord Simpson, very distinguished biologist, in his speech recently said that he had heard about a couple of biology teachers in the college who were bragging about the fact that they had gone one whole semester through biology and hadn't even introduced the concept of the organism yet. They were chemists, and they had so much chemistry to do. One guy said, I'm trying to organize a course in which I won't have to use the concept life. Now, this is biology. The Greek is, bios is the word for life. The science of life, but we've gotten so specialized. And we have attained tremendous power to predict and control in this way. But if everybody gets off into his little corner of the universe and makes his little contribution to the advancement of knowledge, I want to know who takes care of the big questions. And I think there are big questions. While scientists are unlocking the mysteries of DNA, who's dealing with the question, what will we do when we learn how to grow four arms? As one biologist recently said, that's what he wanted. As soon as they're unlocking the genetic code, they're discovering how it is that organisms are shaped. And one of these biologists said, as soon as we get it, I'm going to create people with four arms. And he said, that's what I want, four arms. Because I'm working in the laboratory here and I really need four arms. Two to work with the experiment, one to turn the pages of the manual, and another to bring me the things that I need. And the other guy said, you're making a mistake. Smoke a pipe, you need a fifth bump. but there are, and this may sound ludicrous, but there are very, very important questions here. We are close. We are close to the position where we will be able to affect the basic personality, physiological makeup of people. Before birth, after birth, we can interfere with the genetic code. I don't think that it's enough for people just to learn how to do it. What are we going to do with it when we've got it? But who answers the big question in our time? The answer, I think, is no one. Because we don't officially admit that there are big questions, or at least none which it makes any sense to ask. And if you attempt to ask and answer big questions, they say, well, that just leads to nonsense. And so it turns out that contemporary philosophy won't really quarrel with Esquire. Rationality is finally a form of rationalization. Nothing can be shown to be of any value. Things are not of value, they're just valued. Nothing is good, it's just that people think things are good. Some value this, some value that. There is no truth, there are just truths, which is to say, propositions that make sense within the context of particular frames of reference. Well, it sounds like I'm saying we've gotten very ignorant. We don't know what's coming off. We're all in our little corner of the universe, toiling away, and we're down in the bottom of the ship painting, let's say, and actually a torpedo has blown a hole in the side. But there's a popular slogan of our day that seems to run counter to all this. You often hear it said, oh no, people today are better educated than ever before. People are more knowledgeable, more sophisticated, more rational. We're living in the midst of a veritable knowledge explosion. This is a half-truth at best, and I think it's really a very subtle lie. Because what we are living in today is an information explosion. And there's a big difference between information, which is something that you can use on a quiz show or to fill in the blanks on an objective examination. There's a big difference between that and knowledge, I think. Knowledge is mastery. If you know something, you have power over it. Knowledge requires effort, self-discipline. Knowledge imposes order on information. Knowing is active. The receipt of information is passive, sponge-like. A computer receives information, but it has no knowledge because it arranges this information strictly in accordance with the rules that have been programmed into it as additional pieces of information. And I think it's highly characteristic of our culture that we recognize increasingly no distinction between information and knowledge. Now, we even use the phrase, he's got a well-furnished mind. That phrase bothers me. Somebody's filled in all the little pigeonholes up there. One sign of this failure to distinguish between information and knowledge is our growing fascination with analogies between the computer and the human brain. Another sign of it, one that I think is more serious, is our acceptance of the growing fragmentation of education. Still another symptom is what I call the book of readings complex. Every publisher puts out books of readings by the score. You got a problem like today, the urban problem. Somebody a few years ago recognized that there was an urban crisis. You should see the books that have been multiplied on the urban crisis. But it is really hard to find a book where somebody takes the information, wrestles with it, and tries to master the problem. Instead, what you get is snippets from here and there, a speech by somebody, a statement by somebody else, opposed points of view, no attempt to reconcile them, no attempt to reason one's way through the fundamental issues, but just articles from everywhere. You pour them all together between paper covers as readings on the problem of yakety-yak, and you supposedly have a tool for the education of the young. That's ridiculous. I know you haven't had to use such books if you don't educate anyone. Because what you tell the student is that problems are no longer something to be mastered through disciplined thought or clarified through the dialogue of engaged minds. Problems are to be drowned in the sea of trivia. An example, just to make clear, there was a book of readings that crossed my desk. I was once interested in labor problems, and there was the problem of right-to-work laws. Anti-union security legislation. This is a very thorny problem. It's one in which people get very emotionally involved. There are economic and political and historical and legal issues involved here. And they wanted to deal with that, so they had a section on it. And what they did is they had several statements by union leaders and several statements by the National Association of Manufacturers. And what does the student conclude from this? The truth is somewhere in the middle. Where in the middle? The truth is always somewhere in the middle. But I do not think that when you get two prejudiced viewpoints, obviously prejudiced viewpoints, I mean, when you pick a union leader and an NAM man, you're not going to get an honest confrontation with the issue. You just get two extreme points of view, then the student is left to choose for himself. That's what I mean by the multiplication of trivia. And our culture is tremendously efficient at the multiplication of trivia. We are turning out, we've got technological processes today for highly efficient and low cost accumulation of data, storage, scrambling, transmission, replication, dissemination of information. And these processes have created the possibility, and the decline of reason has done the rest. So that today we are drowning in a flood of books, pamphlets, magazine articles, journals, newspapers, mass mailings, surveys, data summaries, and exposés. Studies are in print almost before the events they describe come to pass. That's true. The Arab-Israeli war last year, within 2 months, there were books out on the war. Now, if you know anything at all about publisher schedules, that's impossible. But you look at the book and you find out what happened. Somebody was doing a study of the Near East. The war came along, the publisher called and said, get the book out, we'll change the title. And he throws in a quickly written, bad last chapter He writes a whole book that doesn't deal with the issue under a title that does seem to make the pretends that the book deals with the issue, and they come out with it and they make money. And there'll be half a dozen books coming out. Consider the Kennedy assassination. The multiplication of trivia. I'm not saying some of the books weren't good, but the books, the magazine articles, everything. Everybody's got his day in court. Every ninny who can say anything sensational gets published. And what are we to make out of all of this? You know, I said getting things out before they happen. The Gallup and the Roper polls now are making it almost unnecessary for us even to vote, because they tell us what happens before it happens. Who are you going to vote for? Vote for the winner, obviously. And who's the winner? It's not determined by how you vote, but by how Gallup and Roper say you will vote. And you know, that's the ultimate. If you try in all of this to get away and say, no, stop, I want to think about it. I want to reflect. I want to reason this through. I want to see what the issues are. People say, oh, you don't have all the information yet. All the data aren't in. All the data are never in. The question is, what are the relevant data? Yet I continually find when I want to discuss some issue with people, academic, educated people, I want to discuss an issue, they say, if the discussion gets anywhere, if they seem to be losing, they say, aha, you haven't read such and such a pamphlet. You can always find a pamphlet that some of us haven't read. I say, well, I won't discuss it with you until you've gone out and read that pamphlet. But the question is, what is relevant? What even does relevant mean? The answer requires a judgment. And a judgment is a creative act of a human being. It's an act of disciplined rationality. An individual can still retreat into some quiet sanctum. He wants to think, to evaluate, determine the relevance of all the information that is pouring from his TV and his newspapers and magazines and books and everywhere else. But this, I think, is not enough. The rational mind wants to engage other minds. I am passionately convinced that our judgments must be tested in the arena of rational discourse, if they're to be made more comprehensive and more acute and more profound. If we are to be rational, especially concerning any public issue, we need one another. Human discourse is not just a way of amusing ourselves, though it is that. And it's not just the mind at play, though it is that too. That's very important. I don't want to underestimate that. But human discourse is the cultivation of rationality and of morality and of humanity itself. That statement may seem to drop from my lips too casually, so I'm going to say it again. When we talk to one another, when we really engage one another in discourse, that doesn't mean you just pat and say, how are you? I'm talking about the engaged dialogue of human beings. When we do this, we are cultivating rationality and morality and humanity itself. We make ourselves through our dialogue with one another. This is the arena in which the spirit of man grows. It's the place where I think the dying spirit of man in our time has the best chance of resurrection. If we learn to talk to one another again, with engagement, with concern. But you know, how is it possible to talk amid all this noise in our home? Turn down that TV! I can't hear what you're saying. And the TV may be just a symptom here. How can we still the noise and restore the possibility of rational dialogue when some of the intellectual leaders of our time are now saying, aha, it is your destiny to be manipulated by information. and that our only salvation lies in accepting the medium as massage. Which gets me to the last thing I wanted to mention, the cult of Marshall McLuhan. Let me say in this, I have learned a great deal from Marshall McLuhan, and I think his book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, is important. I think McLuhan is very often irresponsible in that book, but if you've got a really shocking thesis, sometimes you've got to be irresponsible to get it across. And Understanding Media, I think, is a lesser book, but still an important book. But really, what really bothers me is that last one, The Medium is the Massage. Because this is the one that has created the cult of Marshall McLuhan. This is the one that everybody's running around quoting. And this is the book on the basis of which my students and some of my colleagues who have become devotees of Marshall McLuhan. It's on the basis of this book that they tell me, oh, you're copping out, man, you're not with it, you're not modern. This is 1968. We live in the technological age. We live in the age of electric technology, the extension of the whole central nervous system. And you try to talk to the reason with these people, and they say, you're just a captive of print technology. They've got all the phrases right now. I'll give you some of the phrases. This is what I'm attacking, the cult of Marshall McLuhan. And really, really disturbs me that so many bright people today have sold their souls to this gospel. And if they would just sit down and read Marshall McLuhan, I wouldn't be so bad. All they do is look at this funny little paperback book and think that they have a handle on things. McLuhan says, print technology created the public. Electric technology created the mass. The mass man, you see, the passive receptor, the manipulable object. McLuhan continues, the public consists of separate individuals walking around with separate fixed points of view. But the new technology demands that we abandon the luxury of this posture, that we give up the luxury of having a point of view. Give up the luxury of having a point of view. I never thought that it was a luxury to have a point of view. I thought it was hard work to hammer out a point of view. If we don't have a point of view, what do we have? You just participate. You submit to having your opinions molded by the mass media. The medium is the massage. Be tickled. It is not a luxury to have a fixed point of view. And I don't mean dogmatic or unchangeable. It is discipline. It's hard work. What's the alternative to having a point of view? The alternative is diffuseness. But McLuhan writes, electric circuitry is orientalizing the West. The contained, the distinct, the separate, our Western legacy are being replaced by the flowing, the unified, the fused. The fuzzy, in other words. The new virtue in the gospel, according to McLuhan, is mental inebriation. Have no clear ideas, but just sort of feel your way through. This was once deemed human weakness and a vice. At one time, this teacher could stand in front of his class and say, you're guilty of sloppy thinking. And everyone would. Nowadays, Mandarin of print technology. Of course, we're all supposed to be guilty of sloppy. Sloppy thinking is the new way. Now, McLuhan talks endlessly of the extension of man's nervous system through electric technology. He says, the world is a village. We participate in everything. But do we? Can we participate in everything? Only if participation means faint impression, flitting engagement, fleeting concern. You see, electric technology helps us suppose that we participate in everything. You see, it brings the riot in Newark right into our living rooms. But we do not participate in that riot in Newark by watching it on our television sets. That is ridiculous, because what do? Your wife calls, you're watching, here's the riot, somebody's clubbing somebody else over the head, your wife says, supper's ready, click. That's participation. What happens, rather, is electric technology helps us suppose that we participate in everything, but it fosters apathy and ignorance through sensory overstimulation. it displaces the distinctive human capacity of reason, and it lulls us into accepting the situation by suggesting that we are well informed. The phenomena that McLuhan celebrates, the growth of electric technology, I think these are both cause and effect of the dehumanization of man in our time. But they come to us cunningly disguised as instruments for the extension of man. We're not reminded that it was Joseph Goebbels who did pioneering work in this field, because we're not supposed to inquire into questions of substance. Just the medium is the massage. Be massaged and be there with content. And you have no right to insulate yourself from electric technology to protect. You have no right, McLuhan says, to protect the humanity of your children by turning off the TV and making them read a book. He says, when a child turns off the television and goes to school, he abandons his education. Because his education is coming through the television set. If that's what you mean by education, yes. Just faint impressions, a great blob and blur. But books and schools, although unfortunately schools aren't always much better, but that's supposed to be a place where you work. Where you work out problems. Where you learn that 2 + 3 = 5. Not whatever you happen to feel like today. But anybody who tries to withdraw from all of this is sort of supposed to be a cop-out. You have no right to protect your private life of thought and feeling. There's no longer any such thing as indecent exposure, because all exposure is good and total exposure is best of all. And McLuhan says, we are suddenly eager to have things and people declare their beings totally. We're back to Esquire. Truth is just total exposure. McLuhan's not afraid, he tells us, because he has faith in the ultimate harmony of things. Yeah, that's interesting. What is there to be harmonized if no one has a subjective point of view? There's nothing left to be harmonized. We're all sort of manipulated into a great homogeneous blobby mass. That's the harmony at the end of history, when men have ceased to exist, when men have sold out reason, their spiritual capacity, their power to judge, when men have given up creativity and discipline, when they've decided they're not really human, then you get harmony. It's the kind of harmony that you get in a rat cage after you've performed all the proper things with positive and negative reinforcements. Let me close by making this. You're not going to get a chance to close. Lutheran theologians in the era of high orthodoxy battled strenuously against reason. They quoted Luther, reason is a great whore. You know. They battled in the name of revelation. By and large, they lost the battle in the period of high orthodoxy, as they had to, because reason and revelation can't properly be set in opposition. If, as Paul and Luther maintained, the spirit of man is that rational faculty which enables him to perceive and grasp eternal things, the divine, the unconditioned, the very grace of God, then there is no divine revelation apart from reason. Luther didn't only call reason a harlot. Luther also thought highly of it at times. And that definition of spirit, which I gave from Luther at the beginning, a quote from Luther, that the spirit of man is his rational capacity. This is the place where faith and God's word are at home. Luther also thought highly of reason. He was objecting to certain conclusions that men came to, and so he was, you know, too easy to call Luther like strong language anyway. The point is, you cannot separate revelation from reason. Revelation, totally separated from reason, is demonic. It's not divine, because it's arbitrary. It's capricious. It's without any criterion of truth. And such a concept of revelation is irresponsible. Because everybody can have his own. I mean, I come trotting and I say, I just got a revelation, and my revelation says, let's kill all the Jews. And you say, ooh, let us sit down and reason about this. Say, no, 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 I've got a revelation. Men have had revelations in our time, which they have refused to submit to the test of reason. And I do not think that Christians have any business asserting a revelation which is apart from reason. I do not believe that the scriptures are revelation apart from reason. The reason of man is that which enables him to grasp revelation. Revelation is God revealing something to us, saying something to us. And how does he say it to us? Not through the soles of our feet, but mind, probably, but mostly through our rational capacity. So often seems to me that these gung-ho revelation people are just turning God into some kind of great, powerful television network who overpowers his subjects. He manipulates them into conformity. And they say the medium is the massage. The medium here is the Bible or the catechism or a particular text on dogmatics. And you just sort of plow into this and let yourself be massaged. You cannot relate such a concept of revelation to the Word, the Logos that became flesh and took up residence among us, teaching, participating in our situation, and calling us to turn around. But now here's the thing. The Lutheran theologians in the period of high orthodoxy fought for revelation against reason, and they lost. But now, many years later, they've won the battle. Reason has lost out, and revelation has been crowned king. What the theologians couldn't accomplish, philosophy and culture accomplished for them. Reason is now confined by contemporary dogma to formal logic and linguistic analysis. And I have before me a quotation from a Lutheran dogmatics text, the period of high orthodoxy, that says, reason can serve only an instrumental role. It must be confined to laying down the rules of logic and the analysis of grammar, which is exactly what modern philosophy was. They've won. Man no longer can reason about things. So revelation is king in our culture, any old revelation. Truth is whatever you can get away with. Because there are no criteria for the evaluation of statements. Now, this has been, I'm sure, too abstract. That it makes some difference, I want to try to show Thursday by looking at the area of ethics and politics in our time. The kind of ethical statements we've gotten into the habit of making and the way we organize our political life to talk about it. And I want to try to show that I'm going to come back to this absolute relativism business. And I'm not going to rely on theology at all. I'm just going to rely on the fact that I am a gung-ho, souled member of the liberal democratic tradition of John Locke and Lord Acton and Thomas Jefferson. And I am deeply committed to this. And I'm going to plant myself in that tradition and say that it asserts certain things about man and reason and man's capacities and powers. And that those who, I'll try to show you that those who don't accept those assertions, those fundamental assertions of the liberal democratic tradition, abandon that tradition completely. And I want to suggest that that's why we're getting into certain boxes into which we've gotten. Well, your turn.
Paul, would we as Christians say that what we have as our standard and what is truth for us is not a set of propositions, but a person, the one who said, I am the way and the truth and the life? And therefore, we use him as the ultimate criteria as best we could find out what he said and did through the witness of man.
This still requires reason, does it not?
Yeah.
Okay, that's
Now, what they mean when they say it's not reasonable is when, like Jesus said, like, love your enemies. Now, that, you know, that doesn't seem to make sense. Is that what they mean by the, that when he said love your enemies, this is a revelation which man couldn't have reasoned out, or?
No. What you're referring to at the end is the new revelation.
No, this would be a revelation. In other words, he revealed the way we should act, which we couldn't have reasoned out. Like, love your enemies. This isn't, I don't know, I'm used to saying that wouldn't be rational, or that doesn't make sense.
Well, I think it does make sense. I think it's very rational to love your enemies. It's not always expedient. In a short-term sense, it's not rational, but I think in a very deep sense, that is rational. God is love. And that seems to me to be a statement about the way the world is. And it is rational to live in the world the way she is. And if God is love, you must dwell in the world in love, and everything else is not rational. The problem, of course, is that it is so difficult for us to see this in the situation where we find ourselves. I don't want to get into theological questions like what revelation means. I do feel strongly that revelation involves, let me take that home, revelation involves always a word from God that undercuts a kind of a judgment we make in a concrete situation. The revelation is not God providing us with philosophical truths so much as it ought to be conceived of as God undercutting us. Revelation, for example, I wouldn't get into it now. The Word of God speaks to me not when I read the Bible, let's say, and make certain deductions about how things hang together, but the Word of God, revelation, comes to me when I am behaving in an abominable way. And someone says to me, is that Christian? And then I am recalled to what I have heard in the past. And then the word comes through and it undercuts me. And I was rationalizing. I was saying, well, you know, so I'm picking on him, but that's just righteous indignation. You know, and this is what revelation is, grace. Revelation is God grasping man and making him rational again. But that's can I quit? Yes.
It seems like you've stated a problem about television and in general what you were talking about. Have you got some alternatives to suggest?
I think we have to learn to talk to one another again. And one
good way to say, but that doesn't affect the 60 million television sets in the country, which probably aren't going to get turned off because we say we ought to talk to each other again.
Yeah, well, I can't save the world, I know. But I think each of us, if there's anything to what I'm saying, each of us is going to have to worry about it, deal with it in his own sphere of influence, in his own family, among his own friends. And I think it is possible to do something here.
On an individual basis.
Yeah. Of course, I'm also concerned to get people to see that there are certain presuppositions that underlie a lot of the things that we're doing, and to question those presuppositions. If we can get those presuppositions questioned, then I think we can go a lot farther in extending dialogue among men. For example, right now, in the field of economics where I teach, all of the important questions are dismissed in the first chapter of every textbook by saying that the author will say, try to explain what economics is, and says, economics is a science and deals with facts. Economics does not tell you anything about what ought to be done. That is always based on value judgments. And about value judgments, science cannot speak. Value judgments are personal preferences, and everybody has his own. And so, out that goes. So now you see how this cuts off real dialogue. So the student raises the question in class, and he asks, what should we do about the problem of poverty? And the instructor, he's a good economist, he says, I can't answer that. Well, of course he can't answer it. This is because I'm getting into what I want to get into tomorrow. Of course he can't answer it, but he can engage in the dialogue of creative and concerned minds. He can say to the student, that's what's really the issue. You're right. What are we going to do? Maybe we can talk about it in class. Do some of you want to come into my office and let's talk about it out of class? Let's talk about it. Because none of us really knows. That's a complex problem.
Well, at least I would think economics could suggest some possibilities that would help. And
sure.
Then the value judgment would come in choosing between alternative solutions. And one of the alternative courses of action being, of course, to do nothing. But there are some things that economics might show are impractical, that wouldn't help, that might superficially look like they might be a good thing to do, but you could show that they, by careful analysis.